What?
Good morning.
Welcome to the Board of Public Works. I don't know if you heard that, but the comptroller's mail is being sent to the president's house. I'm not sure how that happens. I'm glad it's not coming to the government house. I probably would have just tossed it in the trash. It's late notice. That's two.
Started like once a month.
Well, first of all, I want to take a moment to congratulate Treasurer Kopp on her re-election by the legislature. I'm really pleased that our colleagues in the General Assembly realized the wisdom of keeping such an incredible person in this position. And together with Treasurer Kopp and Comptroller Francho, I really believe that we have shown that it's possible to accomplish a heck of a lot by working together in a bipartisan way. And I think that's exactly what most Marylanders want us to do. So we haven't agreed on every single issue, but I think when we disagree, we do so in a civil way. I just want to thank Treasurer Kopp. She deserves a lot of the credit for that. And she truly is a dedicated public servant, and I consider it an honor to serve with you. So thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Congratulations. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our distinguished comptroller. Let's go with the treasurer first, since it's her first meeting of her fifth term.
That's it, Mr. Governor. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. This is a unique constitutional body, the Board of Public Works. And I think when all is said and done, not only does it suit Maryland well and help us maintain a strong, well-integrated financial system, starting from, as we will see tomorrow, revenue estimates through debt affordability, through the budget, through balancing the budget after the fact when necessary, through open and transparent procurement and expenditure of state funds. It's unique and I think a very, very good institution, which does not mean that it's always unanimous, but does mean that we can and almost always do operate in a civil way, respecting the concerns of others and understanding that we each represent millions of Marylanders and try to do what is best for them. So with that, Governor, I just want to thank you and say I gather spring is about to be sprung upon us.
And boy, I sure hope so.
None too soon.
Well, I think we're setting a good example for those folks just down the street, 28 miles down the road, down Route 15.
Oh, Lord, I hope so.
Yeah. Mr. Comptroller. Yes.
Thank you, Governor, and Madam Treasurer, and Treasurer Kopp. I join the Governor in congratulating you, and am delighted that we are together for the next few term, and congratulations on the victory. It was tougher behind the scenes than people realized.
It was a great experience.
Yeah, it's a great experience. So, Governor, as everyone here is aware, disturbing reports emerged last week that a member of the General Assembly uttered words that, in my book, disqualify her from holding office. This incident served as a sobering reminder that racism and bigotry, despite the progress that we've made, are alive and well even in the corridors of power in Annapolis. We as Marylanders and as Americans must vehemently reject this blatant expression of hate. And as so many of her colleagues and a chorus of citizens across the state have expressed, she should not continue to hold office. Therefore, I call on the Maryland House of Delegates to expel Delegate Lasanti immediately. While this is undoubtedly a rare, severe, and drastic move, Delegate Lasanti's words are inexcusable. What's more, the attempts to sweep Delegate Lasanti's actions under the rug shed a spotlight on a culture of secrecy that has long been associated with this town, a culture that's been sustained by fears of retribution, and one that encourages people to turn a blind eye to the unethical and immoral behavior that permeates this town. Take this particular event, for example. We're talking about public officials, some of whom are the most influential in this building, enjoying special access, midnight and after hours, to a private cigar lounge that is quite literally a smoke-filled back room in Annapolis. Word gets around this town at lightning speed, and the fact that no one wanted to speak up about this publicly is a damning indictment on the institution where I served 20 years. When did legislative leadership find out about this, and why did it take a bombshell report, not 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but 4 weeks after the incident, for them to take action? Who knew what, when, and why? Why did they stay silent? Delegate Lasanti's constituents deserve answers. The residents of Prince George's County deserve answers. And all Marylanders deserve answers. We have to end this culture of silence and complicity, because this culture only serves those it protects, not the citizens of the state of Maryland. For far too long, people have been silenced and victimized by the abuse that this culture cultivates. And we dishonor those that have entrusted us to serve by sitting idly by and allowing it to continue. I want to specifically thank the Washington Post. Without Ovietta Wiggins and her reporting a month after this outrageous incident occurred, we wouldn't even know about it. Just be part of the secret society down there at the room that you need a special key to get into after hours. So a lot of questions. Hopefully we'll see some more examination of this incident and the cone of silence that descended over it for 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks. Thank goodness the Washington Post exists. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. Now we're going to start with the second.
It is a terrible episode. I agree completely, and I am once again very proud of the Washington Post. Great, great institution. What concerns me about the whole episode is the labeling, in this case a terrible racist label, but we have seen an increasing incidence of labeling people and places, Comptroller, when it's not necessary. And my concern is, as a student of history, and I know you are too, when you start labeling people or groups of people or places as though they were somehow different than you, and they become less than you, and then you can treat them differently. From my perspective, there's the road to hell, because that's where you get to treating people as though they were not fully human. And we've seen this over and over again, not just 150 years ago in slavery, but a generation ago in ovens. And it's something that I think we all have to speak out about when we see it. We've been talking about this. This is not unrelated to the swastikas and the ropes that are around here. Maryland, I hope and believe, was much better than many places, but we're not perfect. And we have a long way to go. And there are pressures at the national level and all over to divide us and to encourage us to see ourselves as somehow different, or others as different, in a way that means it's okay not to think there, but for the grace of God, go I. And this is just one more example. And I know you share that concern, Governor. You've spoken. And I think we just have to speak more loudly and more often, I think.
Absolutely agree. Let's get started with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 27 items on the Secretary's agenda this morning. We have six reports of emergency procurement. We are withdrawing item 7 at the request of the Maryland Stadium Authority.
Any questions on the Secretary's agenda?
Item 27.
Item 27 is the Treasurer's Bond Resolution. Would you like Ms. Binnick to come up, or you want to handle it, Madam Treasurer?
As you know, we will be meeting with the rating agencies on tomorrow to talk to them and try to get them to re-up the AAA bond rating, preparatory to going to the market for about $490 million competitive sale. And we think the market's going to be pretty good. As usual, about 60% or a little more of the funds go to schools and education and the other state projects that come through the normal budget process. Christian Lund is the Director of Debt Management, Governor, Comptroller for your state, and is here to answer any questions that you have about the sale.
Morning, Mr. Lund.
Yes, I just wanted to register my concern about the PLS recommendation that's been published downstairs and commented in the press to cut $76 million from our debt service and tie this board's hands by forcing us to raise the state property tax rate to prevent defaulting on our debts and jeopardize our coveted AAA bond rating. I know it's just a recommendation, but it's in writing and it's down before the second floor or the first floor, and I know some of our friends there have said they don't intend to go that route. Their plan is to find the money within the existing budget to close the budget gap and put a down payment on the Kerwin Commission recommendations. But I spent 20 years on the House Appropriations Committee, and when something, an option like this, low-hanging fruit, comes along that looks easy to pass the buck, so to speak, up here, it's pretty tempting. I'm having a hard time, Governor, getting my head wrapped around the idea that we need to make cuts to the budget and this discussion about should they take this action. I know it's a little bit complicated, but if they take this action, it would force us on the Board of Public Works to raise the state tax property tax rate. It's hard to believe that exists down there, downstairs, with the budget when we reported a surplus of $504 million in July and we wrote the state's revenues up by another $700 million. I've consistently advised, as the chair of the Board of Revenue Estimates, our state leaders in the legislature particularly, to save that money and not spend it. So since we I guess still have $1 billion sitting in the coffers somewhere. How in the world did we get to this point? And why are legislative staffers actually talking about raising taxes on working homeowners or stiffing our creditors? So I hope that that goes nowhere, because it's basically a passing of the obligation from downstairs to up here on the Board of Public Works. And I, for one, am been very clear that I'm not going to play that kind of game. So thank you for being a useful audience for me.
Well, thank you, Mr. Comptroller. I couldn't agree more. The reason I'm governor is because after 43 consecutive tax hikes, taking $10 billion out of the pockets of Marylanders, people were fed up and decided to do something about it. I can tell you that my very first budget we submitted, we eliminated a $5.1 billion structural deficit and been climbing out of the hole and trying to be more fiscally responsible. And now in 60 days, the legislature has already proposed $5.6 billion in mandated spending in spite of declining revenues and a $200 million write-down. And I can assure you, and this is the legislative staff recommendation, and if you hear from the presiding officers, they're not going to do that. But just in case there's any misunderstanding on the part of the Speaker or the Senate President or any of their friends downstairs, there is not going to be a property tax increase. So they're going to have to find another way to maybe tighten their belts and stop increasing mandated spending, because neither the comptroller nor I, and I would imagine not even the treasurer, would want to vote for a property tax increase. So, and I don't want anything to impact our critical AAA bond rating, which is so important to us. And even this kind of crazy talk downstairs is not helpful. So,
Governor, I think sorry, it's quite clear.
We brought you up as the foil here. I didn't intend to do that.
We are going to be our guests. Yes. There's no right. question about that. I want to say your secretary at the hearing in the Senate this week and the House last week made it clear that this administration was not going to be supporting a tax increase, right. and that it wouldn't, in fact, be needed. And the leadership of both committees, but particularly the House committee, as I recall, made a point of saying the staff is supposed to bring up all the ideas they can think of to help reach a yep. bottom line, but we are not pushing this either.
Yeah, last week they recommended eliminating all of the crime-fighting funding for Baltimore Whatever, City, which yeah. we suggested right. to them was not a good idea. Cut that out of our budget.
But that's their jobs, they yeah. the staff.
Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda? Is there a motion?
Move favorable.
Second? All those in favor? 3-0. Now we're going to move on to the DNR real property agenda, and I want to welcome and congratulate our newest member of our cabinet, Secretary Jeannie Hadaway Riccio. She was just confirmed in the Senate, and she's had a long distinguished career in the legislature, in the House of Delegates, and then served admirably as my Deputy Chief of Staff, and we're very sorry to lose her here off the second floor, but we think she's going to do a terrific job running the Department of Natural Resources. So welcome, Jeannie. We're happy to have you.
And good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio, Acting Secretary of Natural Resources. Today we have 13 items on our real property agenda for which we are seeking approval.
Any questions on DNR?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. That's it's not going to always be like that.
I'll take it.
Good start, though. Up next we have the Department of Business and Management.
Thank you, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. We have 16 items for your consideration. Items 7, 8, and 9 have been revised, and 16 is a supplemental, and I have people here to address any concerns or questions you may have.
Questions on DBM?
Item 4.
Item 4S Mod. Emily Brandenburg, Deputy for Finance for MSDE. Or is Jennifer Judkins here?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. This apparently is a request from your agency to retroactively approve modifications to a contract with Measured Progress for the development, administration, and scoring of the state high school assessments for government and science. And I'll spare you and my colleagues reiterating my concerns and strong opposition to the outsized role that standardized testing has had in our public education systems and how it has transformed the classroom learning experience from one where the teacher has the flexibility to tailor lesson plans for their students to one where they are essentially required to teach test materials. These standardized tests have succeeded in taking the joy out of teaching, period. I do want to follow up, however, on a discussion that Dr. Salmon and I had at our March 2017 board meeting, since I mentioned that this contract was reduced by nearly $1.3 million to reduce human scoring labor through the use of artificial intelligence. Isn't that a sad commentary on the state of our society? That a robot, does a better job at determining whether or not a student answered the question correctly, better job than human beings. So I think I asked that teachers, public school teachers in Maryland, be paid to review these. Many of them are essays, I'm told. but instead we have a robot looking at the essay. But I'll put that aside. Last March, I floated the idea of having teachers who need a little extra cash in their pockets be a supplementary source of income, and obviously are better than a machine in reading and evaluating an essay. So apparently Dr. Salmon said back then, we're going to definitely look into it. So I guess my question is, where are we on that?
Thank you. Thank you for your question. I'm Emily Brandenburg. I'm the Deputy for Finance Administration at MSDE. And with me I have Dr. Dudkins, and I think she's probably best suited to answer that question for you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Yes, and we actually, for the AI scoring, the artificial intelligence, we have the human scoring as well. So it's just a backup. It's a redundant. So we have two scores, both a human and a computer score. And then we compare those two scores to see how well they agree. So humans are still scoring them, but again, it is a cost savings to train the AI engine. So who are the
humans? Are they public school teachers in the state?
The scoring does happen outside of our state. It could be Maryland teachers, but we couldn't guarantee it.
So the answer is you looked at it, but you didn't do anything. You looked at it, you didn't do anything. About hiring Maryland public school teachers
to be involved and be a part of this. Some will, but we could guarantee all of them would be. Right.
Yeah, so good. I mean, really.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a conflict of interest as well. If we have all Maryland school teachers doing it, because then they could possibly be scoring their own students' work, and we would need to be, that would be.
So we want to have a robot do it.
What's that?
We want to have a robot do it. Out-of-state robot.
No, that just actually, it increases or decreases the time. But we still have human scoring, and some are Maryland teachers. But
how many humans?
How many altogether doing the scoring?
Yeah, how many humans?
It would depend on the number of test items coming in. I don't have those numbers right now.
Well, could you get them to us?
Sure.
Because it sounds to me like 98% robots.
No, 100% of the scores would be human scored, 100% by AI, and then we check the agreement. So every item scored on HSA is actually human scored.
So maybe this is an issue that you and Dr. could follow up with the comptroller on so that you can address any concerns that he may have.
Okay,
sure,
thank you.
Certainly, happy to do it. Thank you.
I have a brief question on item 3, the commerce.
Elizabeth Fitzsimmons, Executive Director of Tourism. Is she here?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's actually of you specifically. Yeah, please, you specifically. Could you identify yourself?
Yes, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Fitzsimmons, Managing Director for the Division of Tourism, Film, and the Arts. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Yes, well, as you know, the question came up from a number of different people about why we were using out-of-state vendors, essentially, instead of in-state for advertising and getting people to know our state, which seemed a reasonable question.
Right.
And your response was because over time, over the last several years, the number of, the number of firms in Maryland that were competent to do these things has reduced significantly. And, of course, we're also trying to reach out-of-state people to come into Maryland. I'm not sure I buy all that, but that aside, this is the Department of Commerce. I know you're the tourism. And one of the functions of the Department of Commerce is to grow commerce in Maryland. So that being the case, what are we doing to remedy this situation and to help grow our in-state businesses so that there are more to compete?
Right. Brenda Lee is with me. She can handle the procurement issue, but if it's more of a global.
Yeah.
I also have Deputy Secretary Ben Wu here with us. The capacity issue that we addressed in our response is really about, you know, their bandwidth, their capacity to do that. There are smaller firms who can't really ramp up to that. We do have...
parts of it. That was the other question.
Right. And they do, and we have a lot of smaller firms who are coming in under the MBE requirements, and then folks that we just know work really well in that capacity, and we bring them in and we share that contract with them.
So what can we do more to assure that we not only bring them in and they know about it, but
right.
they actually get jobs?
Well, with magazine publishing and digital content development, it really is, in some ways, it's somewhat of a risky business. Publishing is very volatile right now. Everyone said a few years ago that print would be dead, and it hasn't, and it's actually still there, but it is a really risky venture, and putting that kind of money and resources, personal resources, forward to start up that kind of business.
So one thing we could be doing is looking at risk mitigation, maybe.
Right.
I mean, this is a high-level question, but clearly there is a need for these sorts of businesses, mm-hmm. and they'll be continuing, and they'll have different facets, some
right.
digital, some hard, all sorts of things.
And we should
be growing.
And we did have local firms who were part of the bid process and who chose not to respond. And Brenda does have that information. Ms. Lee does have that information.
That to us.
But they realized in aspects that they really didn't have the capacity to meet the demands of bringing, 41 million visitors to the state
right.
of Maryland and generating $18 billion in revenue
so
for the state.
Then I guess the question is, looking at this construct, if there is a way without costing significantly more money for them to bring $10 million and somebody else to bring $10 million using a different device. This is just an area I think it would be useful to pursue.
Right. And
I'm not voting against this contract.
No, we understand that, and we are very cognizant of the fact that when we do these bids and looking at in-state versus out-of-state firms, we agonize over that
Maryland
process.
Maryland used to be home of the premier
and so many printing presses now are of all consolidated, and now there's only really three of them, and there were several here in Maryland at a time back when I first started.
So we can do for the future, whether through new technology or partnering with other groups to help reinvigorate. I would think. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Item 9S, please.
9S, MSDE, Amelie. You were just here. Amelie Brandenburg.
Yes, thank you. Welcome back. This is a request from the Department of Education to award a 3-year single bid contract with 2 1-year renewal options to Novi Group, a Tennessee-based firm for research and data analysis for the child care subsidy program. My questions really go to the procurement of this contract, specifically the disqualification of the incumbent vendor, Towson University-based Regional Economic Studies Institute, or RESI, I guess is its...
RESI.
What is it? RESI. From apparently prohibited, the procurement prohibited them from submitting a bid for this contract. It's my understanding that the 2018 budget bill language specifically forbade the department from using contractual services through an interagency agreement, i.e., Towson University. Instead, the budget bill allowed the department to only use contractual services that were obtained through competitive bid. Hence, we have the single bid vendor request before us. The joint chairman's report provided even greater insight into this highly irregular language in a budget document. Specifically, this budget language was exclusively targeting the Towson University-based group. It says, RESI, quote, RESI has been unable to produce accurate estimates in recent years, particularly since the reauthorization of the Federal Child Care and Development Block Grant, end of quote, from the budget bill. I sat on the House Appropriations Committee for 20 years. I chaired two of its subcommittees. I have to tell you, Governor and Treasurer, I don't recall instances when budget committees got involved in the procurement process by barring a specific vendor and a public institution, no less, Towson University, from participating in the procurement process. And it's my understanding that RESI did, in fact, submit a bid and filed a protest after the award went to the Novi Group out of state, Tennessee, and their bid was rejected on the grounds that any award to RESI would take the form of an interagency agreement and therefore violate the budget bill mandate. So my first question is, did the Department of Education make this request to the budget committees that RESI be excluded from participating in the procurement process?
We did not.
Did you?
We did not.
So where did we think it came from?
I would be speculating.
That's the first time I've heard of it.
So I guess my second question is this. Was, yeah, exactly. Was, in fact, RESI doing a poor job and producing inaccurate data, as the Joint Chairman's report states? Where did they get that information? What? Yeah.
Make a motion.
To defer?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to defer.
What is the impact of...
Yeah, what is the... I mean, if you guys, they must have heard from somebody that they weren't, you or someone didn't think they were performing up to expectation. That's not a reason to ban them from a procurement. I don't remember that ever happening in budget bill language.
No, I don't either.
I'm going to make a motion that we defer this item. We'll pull this out of the...
Thank you, Governor.
We have to get more information. This doesn't sound even legal to me. It's the first time I heard of it. Thank you, Mr. Comptroller, for bringing it up to our attention. We want to have budget and our legal team take a look at where this budget language came from
and what the origin of it is,
how in the hell this came before us.
Yeah, we'll get back to you on it. I do know that in the conference committees they were inserting some because there's been special attention paid to all of these agreements. There's been an allegation on some regards that they...
Let's get all the information since we don't have it today, and let's defer the item.
Yeah, I have seen it at a higher level.
There's a motion. It's been seconded. All those in favor?
Yeah.
3-0. Thank you.
Governor, number 8, I just want to say that I support item 8. It's the Baltimore City Community College procurement, retroactive procurement. I get it. And I understand there is an effort to give Baltimore City Community College greater independent procurement authority, like St. Mary's or Morgan. And I would hope if this happens that you would work with the community college to support their capacity to do procurement. I don't know. I'm looking at DGS and you, Mr. Secretary, because, I mean, there are just decades and decades of issues, and Baltimore City Community College has made great strides recently in reorganization, new board, et cetera, but there is a history of problems with procurement, et cetera, and I just... would hate, after all the work we did to build it up, and it's the state's only state community college, really, that we not continue to provide assistance, whether it's independent in law or not, continue to provide the assistance and the technical support that's needed so that they can actually accomplish their job. Just a little editorial.
Any other questions on the DBM agenda?
Move approval.
So we're going to pull out the one item and move approval on the remainder. Second. 3-0. Move on to the university system. Good morning. Mr. Evans.
Morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 3 items on the agenda. We're here to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Evans? Motion.
Move approval.
Second. 3-0.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to IT.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mike Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 17 items on the agenda, and I do have agency representatives available to answer any questions.
Any questions? Is the Lieutenant Governor? Yeah. I'd like to highlight item 6. And in order to do that, I'm going to ask Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, who is leading our procurement modernization efforts, to tell us a little bit about eMaryland Marketplace Advantage, which is the latest milestone in our efforts to transform state procurement. Good morning, Mr. Lieutenant Governor.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Good to see you all this morning. Yes, I'm here to support Item 6 IT. It's a major milestone in our procurement efforts to modernize the procurement process. It revolutionizes them. It takes us a step closer to achieving that transformation that the governor charged us with and the Procurement Modernization Commission. eMaryland Marketplace Advantage is a much more, it is much more than just the state's new bid board. It's an adaptive tool, which I guess you'll hear a little bit more about, provides innovation and flexibility over time. It fits the modernization goals that the commission had for innovation and efficiency, and it'll help with our future needs as part of a full procurement and business process transformation. In functional terms, it is evolutionary. It's a leap from our current system, and we'll now have integration with the MBE directory, direct integration with FEMIS, the financial management system, which I think it would have something that the Treasurer and Comptroller would appreciate, electronic forms, signatures, customized reporting for all users, including the counties, municipalities, and local school systems, advanced data reporting and analytics, and robust contract management tools are also there to provide real-time tracking of management and contract spend rates. So there should be, Mr. Comptroller, no more excuses for extending contracts so that they can get them through the procurement process. Like, I think there were a couple of items, was it 14 and 15 service contracts today? I think you already controlled that, went past those. I do read the items. 14 and 15 were modifications to extend for procurement. So accordingly, I asked the board to approve this item. And then I'm going to turn it over to those who have been much more directly involved in this procurement. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Lieutenant Governor, any questions?
If I could just echo the governor's praise and thank you for that very detailed explanation of the contract. But most of all, I just want to compliment you, Lieutenant Governor, on the leadership that you provided on an issue that puts most people to sleep.
Mundane but meaningful.
Yeah. But it deals with the outdated procurement system that we have. And thank you for your leadership. I'd like to commend the Hogan administration for bringing agencies from across state government together, including my own agency, to take part in this procurement of critically important items and make sure that all the I's were dotted and the T's crossed. And it's a very large contract, $70 million over a 20-year term. And as you noted, it has the potential and I think will deliver efficiency and other capabilities to our current e-market marketplace. I do have two questions just for the record. With respect to data security, what protections have been built into this contract to ensure that bids submitted by vendors will be kept confidential until they submit?
Okay, I'll let the procurement professionals. I hope is Bob Gleason here?
I am.
Oh, never mind. They're here. But before I leave, I do want to give credit to General Services, Budget and Management, IT, and the whole team for putting this together. And led by Bob Gleason, who is our senior procurement executive, who came in, we stole him from Virginia, came in and has done an excellent job in pulling the team together. And also, I decided to dress like you, Mr. Franchot, today, so.
Hey, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, before you leave, I want to just thank you for your leadership, and I want to thank all of the staff that's worked so hard. I mean, both the comptroller's office and her team, the comptroller and the treasurer, both of their teams were integral to this entire process. I mean, I think this new system is going to greatly enhance the accounting and business processes, and I want to thank all of our agencies. You know, Department of Budget Management, the DGS, DOIT, Transportation, and everybody that's worked. And, you know, we're all looking forward to full implementation, and I want to thank you all. So sorry to interrupt.
No,
you're right. I want to say that before he went back to work.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the question is data security. How are we assuring that as far as the confidentiality of the procurement.
Sure. Rachel Hershey, Department of Budget and Management, Procurement Officer for this project.
Can you step closer to the microphone, please?
Yeah, sorry. So data security in this system will be more secure than in the current system, for sure, because in FEMIS and eMaryland Marketplace, we have some social security numbers, PII. None of that would be present in the current system. The data would be masked. Every key strike in this system would be auditable. Auditors can go in and see what has occurred from the point a requisition is entered into the system until wherever it is when they pick it up.
Okay. Do your colleagues want to add anything to that? Or?
Good morning. Sachin Bhatt, Director of Procurement at the Department of IT. I just want to add, we do have the vendors here that are able to discuss more of the security protocols if the board so chooses.
No, I just want to make sure you guys are on top of the confidentiality.
Sure.
We probably wouldn't understand if you got any more
detail. But I did have a second question, which is under a previous administration, we had the notorious Maryland Health Exchange experience, and that's still fresh on my mind. And so the question is, how protected are Maryland taxpayers should this, when you turn the switch on, heaven forbid, not work? What's protection built into the procurement for the state in the event that the vendor is unable to deliver on this ambitious range of services?
So we have, obviously, liquidated damages baked into the contract, as well as the normal contract protections. We have a phased implementation approach, so we'll be doing things in smaller pieces, replacing the current functionality of eMaryland Marketplace before this summer, before looking at the larger pieces of functionality. So it will be a slow phase, slow not necessarily, but phased by size implementation.
Incremental,
thank you. We have a project manager that's coming on board to manage the process to ensure that the contractor sticks to deadlines proposed in the implementation plan.
Okay, thank you, Governor.
Thank you.
Could I build on that, if I might? You have a rollout plan, then, for the different increments. Do we have that? I haven't seen that. Could we see that, please?
It was submitted. Okay. Jamie Tomaszewski, Department of Budget and Management,
right.
Chief of
Procurement.
Could you send it to me? I will send it directly to you, Treasurer.
And
but, yeah, we have the
with names
schedule.
Attached to who's responsible and what dates are anticipated.
We don't have that detail yet, but we have the overall plan.
Okay.
Part of our implementation.
This is a complicated thing.
Right. Part of our implementation process with our new contractor, once awarded, will be to set up the specifics of what people are needed
at
what
point.
Well, I would
like to see that, because we've gotten a lot of words.
We have an overall, yeah.
A lot of words, very good words, but it's easier sometimes when you can see it actually spelled out and know what to anticipate when and whom to contact when there are issues. The other thing is how you went from about 40 million to 70 million. What is involved in that, and is that going to be tied also to this rollout? This is $70 million.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, so as part of the evaluation, we evaluated core e-procurement functionality. And so the total evaluated price is based on this core e-procurement functionality, and that was to ensure that we had an apples-to-apples comparison among the offers. We also asked the offers to propose other related procurement enhancements, which may vary among the offers. And so the difference between the total evaluated price and the award amount reflects different optional modules that, for example, advanced analytics, program management, accruals, expense management, things that we feel would really enhance our business process transformation that are specific to this vendor. Other vendors had different ones. They may have had some of the same. But in order to preserve the apples-to-apples comparison for the financial comparison, we had those priced as optional features. So when you add the optional features to the evaluated price, you are presented with the award amount.
And then you're going to decide in the second year or whenever which of those optional features.
That's correct. certain of them are already in the award amount. They're reflected in the $70
million. Yeah. So they've basically already been decided, and that's what we're presenting to you today, is the full package of what we believe the eMaryland Marketplace Advantage will bring to the state with those optional features that NITOR has provided in the proposal.
Okay. I have to say, and I trust everybody we have, it's a confusing and sort of almost in some ways incomplete explanation on the item itself, which I think the sort of rollout document that I'm talking about could help clarify. But it's time to have a new system, and I congratulate you and everyone who was involved in bringing it about.
And we'll definitely keep everyone in in our communications on the rollout and as things are happening, because we're all excited about this too, so we want to make sure that everyone stays involved and understands the processes as they are happening.
Well, we'll be watching. Thank you. Good luck.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the Do It agenda?
Move approval.
Second? 3-0. Move on to transportation.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Governor, good morning. For the record, my name is Jim Quartz, Deputy Secretary for Maryland Department of Transportation. Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 13 items today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I'm just going to, again, take a moment to shamelessly use item 3, which is an expedited procurement for improvements to BWI, to again congratulate Ricky Smith and his team at BWI, which I seem to be doing a lot every time he comes before us, but give him a shout-out because we've had another, yet again, record-breaking year, 4 years in a row. 2018, passenger traffic at the airport reached a record 27 million. And I'm very proud to say that BWI Marshall is the number one airport in the Washington region, which most people don't know. The people in Virginia keep thinking it's Dulles, and I have to keep reminding them that we're beating the socks off of them. So congratulations, Ricky, to you and your team.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Governor. It has everything to do with your vision, and we appreciate your continued support. Hopefully we'll have other opportunities for you to commend us as well. So, again, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, let me just join the governor. BWI is a gem, along with being an economic catalyst. And thank you, Mr. Smith, and also Southwest and all the other big airlines that are operating up there. I voted against this expedited contract, but you're now bringing this before us. I'm going to support you here.
Thank you, sir.
You're running a good ship up there, so keep it up.
Thank you. It has everything to do with
it's actually
team.
Not a ship, it's a plane.
Support the port.
Good for making records at the port every month, also. We missed the boat, but we're getting catching the plane.
Yeah.
But thank you. We also have two people signed up to speak.
Ricky, I just want to add, I appreciate your.
Oh, they're not speaking? Okay.
I appreciate your bringing this back to us.
Yes, ma'am.
I hope there's not a misunderstanding. There may be, but that will come out, I suppose, at the meeting in May. I thought there was an agreement that we would go forward and do all these improvements at A-Gate, and there would not be a net increase at BWI and therefore not opening at C-Gate, which would be a net increase. Until after it went through the Board of Public Works.
Correct.
But now I'm hearing that that's not the story, so I guess we'll hear next in May.
Well,
will be troubled if.
Well, just for clarification, Madam Treasurer, what you stated is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Once we complete the A extension and the AB corridor work, there will be a net 5 additional gates. What I testified to in July was that those 5 surplus gates would exist on Concourse C. We will come back to the board and report what we plan to do with those 5 gates on Concourse C.
Which may be keeping them closed in order not to increase traffic until action is taken by the FAA.
Well, Madam Treasurer, maybe that's where the confusion.
Maybe it is. Yeah,
well, it was never my intent to suggest that they would be closed.
We can discuss that when we come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Any other questions on the transportation agenda?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. And last but not least, Secretary Churchill, we're going to move on to DGS.
Well, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Department of General Services. The department has 58 items on our agenda. We are withdrawing item 37. And I do want to thank the board for approving item 6 under Jewett's agenda, as we are co-owners. And I do want to thank all the members of the team that made this happen, especially the lieutenant governor, who has been laser-focused to our success. We're available to answer any questions that you may have at this time.
Did you say 58 items?
37 items.
Oh, 37.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, 58 items. We do. It's two agendas.
That might be a record. You certainly won today, so...
We always like to be the best.
So I see Rodney Gill sitting here before us. He's the CEO of the YMCA of the Chesapeake. If we send any more money down there, the place is going to sink. But, Robbie, maybe with the governor's indulgence, you could tell us what this $500,000 capital grant for the new St. Michael's Y, which apparently is including a senior center, how that's going.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Controller, Mr. Governor. Madam Treasurer, thank you for the opportunity to be here and for supporting the work of the YMCA. My name is Robbie Gill. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the YMCA of the Chesapeake, serving the Eastern Shore of Maryland. This particular project is very unique in that it's a multiple partnership, so it's located on school property within St. Michael's for ease of access for kids and families, but it's also a senior center and a YMCA, so when the county was looking to expand senior center programming within St. Michael's in the Bay 100 area, and the Y was trying to expand services to better serve those communities that are oftentimes isolated from opportunities in Easton. It made a lot of sense in a smaller community to partner and collaborate together. And so this YMCA will be a joint use facility. The county and the senior center will be able to provide congregate meals 3 days a week for seniors there. You'll have a hub of activity where kids can go there after school. It gives us a great opportunity for intergenerational programming. And the beauty of the YMCA is the Y turns no one away due to financial limitations, so everyone has the opportunity to participate. That YMCA is currently serving, we have a small facility there now, serving half of the population of St. Michael's in the Bay 100. And with this senior center YMCA facility, once it's completed, it'll serve nearly 4 and 5 people on a weekly basis. So I appreciate your support of that effort. We're extremely excited about it. Hope to see you there soon in June when that facility opens. So thank you so much for supporting it.
It's a great catalyst. How many people do you serve all of your entire system?
40,000 members across the Eastern Shore of Maryland, but then another 20,000 in other programs and services. The Y partners with nearly 100 different not-for-profits across counties on the Eastern Shore to support work that they're doing to make a positive impact. So, we appreciate your support of not only the YMCA across the state, but also charities that do meaningful work to make our state a better place.
And I see you have one of my favorite people with you in the entire state, Carrie Foxwell.
Absolutely.
Thank you for running a good ship, so to speak, down there.
And for keeping that other Foxwell straight.
Yeah,
that's a real job.
That's hard.
But I'd also like to say this senior center is, I talk about my dad a lot, he's going to be 97, March 27th, and I say to him, Dad, how are you doing? He said, I'm lonely. He's lonely. He lives with 2,800 people, and he says he's lonely. But this interaction that someone like him, if he went to a senior center and could get interaction with young people and give them some of the benefit of his life experiences.
Yeah, Shaldine Brooks, who runs that program, would say seniors don't like the word senior center, but a place where they can connect to one another, but also give back and work with our local youth as mentors and role models makes a huge difference. And so to have all those people come into one place, creating one community there, is going to be really powerful. And I think you'll see in the future that model will be replicated in other communities on the Eastern Shore and probably through the state.
It sounds like an incredible model, and I want to thank you for your leadership. It sounds like something that can be a prototype that should be used maybe across the state. So I want to thank the Y.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Great. Any other questions on DGS?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you.